and a small buckler strapped to his left arm, but carried no weapons. The dwarf on the left had no shield, but in his right hand he held a javelin poised to throw. Eragon held his breath as the distance between the Feldenos narrowed. When they were less than 30 feet apart, the dwarf with the spear whipped his arm through the air and launched the missile at his opponent. The other dwarf did not cover himself with his shield, but rather reached out and with amazing dexterity caught the spear by the shaft. He brandished it over his head. The crowd gathered around the lists let out a resounding cheer, which Eragon joined in, clapping vigorously.
"That was skillfully done," exclaimed Oric.
He laughed and drained his tankard of mead, his polished coat of mail sparkling in the early evening light. He wore a helm embellished with gold, silver, and rubies, and on his fingers 5 large rings. At his waist hung his ever-present axe. Havedra was attired even more richly, with strips of embroidered cloth upon her sumptuous dress, strands of pearls and twisted gold around her neck, and in her hair an ivory comb set with an emerald as large as Eragon's thumb. A line of dwarves stood and winded a set of curved horns, the brassy notes echoing off the mountains. Then a barrel-chested dwarf stepped forward, and in dwarvish announced the winner of the last contest, as well as the names of the next pair to compete in the Gastgar. When the Master of Ceremonies finished speaking, Eragon bent over and asked, "Will you be accompanying us to Farthendur, Havedra?" She shook her head and smiled widely.
"I cannot. I must stay here and tend to the affairs of the Injitum while Oric is gone, so he does not return to find our warriors starving and all our gold spent."
Chuckling, Oric held out his tankard toward one of the servants, standing several yards away. As the dwarf hurried over and refilled it with mead from a pitcher, Oric said to Eragon with obvious pride,
"Havedra does not boast. She is not only my wife, she is the...
you have no word for it.
She is the Grimstkarvlors of Dur Grimst in Jitum. Grimstkarvlors means the keeper of the house, the arranger of the house. It is her duty to ensure that the families of our clan pay their agreed-upon tithes to Bregan Hold, that our herds are driven to the proper fields at the proper times, that our stocks of feed and grain do not fall too low, that the women of the Injitum weave enough fabric, that our warriors are well equipped, that our smiths always have ore to smelt into iron, and in short, that our clan is well managed and will prosper and thrive. There is a saying among our people, a good Grimstkarvlors can make a clan, and a bad Grimstkarvlors will destroy a clan," said Havedra.
Oric smiled and clasped one of her hands in his.
"And Havedra is the best of Grimstkarvlorsen. It is not an inherited title. You must prove that you are worthy of the post if you are to hold it. It is rare for the wife of a Grimstborith to be Grimstkarvlors as well. I am most fortunate in that regard."
Bending their heads together, he and Havedra rubbed noses. Eragon glanced away, feeling lonely and excluded. Leaning back, Oric took a draught of mead, then said,
"There have been many famous Grimstkarvlorsen in our history. It is often said that the only thing we clan leaders are good for is declaring war on each other, and that the Grimstkarvlorsen prefer we spend our time squabbling among ourselves, so we do not have the time to interfere in the workings of the clan."
"Come now, Skilfstelva," chided Havedra. "You know that is not truth. Or it shall not be truth with us."
Said Oric, and touched his forehead to Havedra's. They rubbed noses again. Aragorn returned his attention to the crowd below as it erupted in a frenzy of hissing and jeering. He saw that one of the dwarves competing in the Gastgar had lost his nerve and at the last moment had yanked his Feldunost off to one side and even then was attempting to flee his opponent. The dwarf with the javelin pursued him twice around the lists. When they were close enough, he rose up in his stirrups and cast the spear, striking the cowardly dwarf in the back of his left shoulder. With a howl, the dwarf fell off his steed and lay on his side, clutching at the blade and shaft embedded in his flesh. A healer rushed toward him. After a moment, everyone turned their backs on the spectacle.
Oryk's upper lip curved with disgust. "Bah! It will be many years before his family is able to erase the stain of their son's dishonor. I am sorry you have had to witness this contemptible act, Aragorn."
It's never enjoyable watching someone shame themselves. The three of them sat in silence through the next two contests. Then Oryk startled Aragorn by grasping him by the shoulder and asking,
"How would you like to see a forest of stone, Aragorn?"
"No such thing exists, unless it is carved." Oryk shook his head, his eyes twinkling.
"It is not carved, and it does exist. So I ask again, would you like to see a forest of stone?"
"If you are not jesting, yes, I would."
"Ah, I am glad you accept it. I do not jest, and I promise you that tomorrow you and I shall walk among trees of granite. It is one of the wonders of the Beor Mountains. Everyone who is a guest of Durgrimst in Jeetum should have an opportunity to visit it."
The following morning, Aragorn rose from his too small bed, in his stone room with its low ceiling and half-sized furniture, washed his face in a basin of cold water, and out of habit, reached with his mind towards Saphira. He felt only the thoughts of the dwarves and the animals in and around the hold. Aragorn faltered and leaned forward, gripping the rim of the basin. Overcome by his sense of isolation, he remained in that position, unable to move or think, until his vision turned crimson and flashing spots floated in front of his eyes. With a gasp, he exhaled and refilled his lungs. "I missed her during the trip from Helgrind," he thought, "but at least I knew I was returning to her as fast as I could. Now I am travelling away from her, and I do not know when we will be reunited." Shaking himself, he dressed and made his way through the winding corridors of Bregan Hold, bowing to the dwarves he passed, who for their part greeted him with energetic reiterations of "Hajitlam!" He found Oryk and 12 other dwarves in the courtyard of the hold, saddling a line of sturdy ponies, whose breath formed white plumes in the cold air. Aragorn felt like a giant as the short, burly men moved about him. Oryk hailed him.
"We have a donkey in our stables, if you would like to ride."
"No, I'll continue on foot, if it's all the same to you." Oryk shrugged.
"As you wish."
When they were ready to depart, Hevedra descended the broad stone steps from the entrance to the main hall of Bregan Hold, her dress trailing behind her, and presented to Oryk an ivory horn, clad with gold filigree around the mouth and bell. She said,
"This was mine father's when he rode with Grimstborith Aldrim. I give it to you so you may remember me in the days to come."
She said more in Dwarvish, so softly Aragorn could not hear, and then she and Oryk touched foreheads. Straightening in his saddle, Oryk placed the horn to his lips and winded it. A deep, rousing note rang forth, increasing in volume until the air within the courtyard seemed to vibrate like a wind-sawed rope. A pair of black ravens rose from the tower above, cawing. The sound of the horn made Aragorn's blood tingle. He shifted in place, eager to be gone. Lifting the horn over his head, and with a final look at Hevedra, Oryk spurred his pony forward, trotted out of the main gates of Bregan Hold and turned east, toward the head of the valley. Aragorn and the 12 other dwarves followed close behind. For 3 hours they followed a well-worn trail across the side of Thardor Mountain, climbing ever higher above the valley floor. The dwarves drove the ponies as fast as they could without injuring the animals, but their pace was still only a fraction of Aragorn's speed when he was free to run unchecked. Although he was frustrated, Aragorn refrained from complaining, for he realized that it was inevitable he would have to travel slower with any but elves or Kull. He shivered and pulled his cloak closer around himself. The sun had yet to appear over the Beor Mountains, and a damp chill pervaded the valley, even though noon was only a few hours away. Then they came upon a flat expanse of granite over 1,000 feet wide, bordered on the right by a slanting cliff of naturally formed octagonal pillars. Curtains of shifting mist obscured the far end of the stone field. Oric raised a hand and said,
"Behold, Ajnur Drathen!"
Aragorn frowned. Stare as he might, he could discern nothing of interest in the barren location. "I see no forest of stone." Clambering down from his pony, Oric handed the reins to the warrior behind him and said,
"Walk with me, if you would, Aragorn."
Together, they strode toward the twisting bank of fog, Aragorn shortening his steps to match Oric's. The mist kissed Aragorn's face, cool and moist. The vapor became so thick that it obscured the rest of the valley, enveloping them in a featureless grey landscape where even up and down seemed arbitrary. Undaunted, Oric proceeded with a confident gait. Aragorn, however, felt disoriented and slightly unsteady, and he walked with a hand held out in front of him in case he should bump into anything hidden within the fog. Oric stopped at the edge of a thin crack that defaced the granite they stood on, and said,
"What see you now?"
Squinting, Aragorn swept his gaze back and forth, but the fog seemed as monotonous as ever. He opened his mouth to say as much, but then noticed a slight irregularity in the texture of the mist to his right, a faint pattern of light and dark that held its shape even while the mist drifted past. He became aware of other areas that were static as well, strange, abstract patches of contrast that formed no recognizable objects. "I don't..." he started to say, when a breath of wind ruffled his hair. Under the gentle encouragement of the newborn breeze, the fog thinned, and the disjointed patterns of shade resolved into the boles of large, ash-coloured trees, with bare and broken limbs. Dozens of the trees surrounded him and Oric, the pale skeletons of an ancient forest. Aragorn pressed his palm against a trunk. The bark was as cold and hard as a boulder. Blotches of pallid lichen clung to the surface of the tree. The back of Aragorn's neck prickled. Although he did not consider himself overly superstitious, the ghostly mist and the eerie half-light, and the appearance of the trees themselves, grim and foreboding and mysterious, ignited a spark of fear inside of him. He wet his lips and asked, "How did these come to be?" Oric shrugged.
"Some claim that Gunterra must have placed them here when he created Alagazia out of nothingness. Others claim Helsfog made them, for stone is his favourite element, and would not the god of stone have trees of stone for his garden? And still others say no, that once these were trees like any others, and a great catastrophe eons ago must have buried them in the ground, and that over time wood became dirt, and dirt became stone."
"Is that possible?"
"Only the gods know for certain. Who besides them can hope to understand the whys and wherefores of the world?"
Oric shifted his position.
"Our ancestors discovered the first of the trees while quarrying granite here over 1,000 years ago. The then Grimstborith of Durgrimst in Jutum, Valmar Lackhand, stopped the mining and instead had his masons chisel out the trees from the surrounding stone. When they had excavated nigh on 50 trees, Valmar realized that there might be hundreds or even thousands of stone trees entombed within the side of Mount Thardor, and so he ordered his men to abandon the project. This place, however, captured the imagination of our race, and ever since Nerlen from every clan have travelled here and laboured to extricate more trees from the grip of the granite. There are even Nerlen who have dedicated their lives to the task. It has also become a tradition to send troublesome offspring here, to chisel out a tree or two while under the supervision of a master mason.
That sounds tedious.
It gives them time to repent of their ways.
With one hand, Oryx stroked his braided beard.
I spent some months here myself, when I was a rambunctious lad of 34.
And did you repent of your ways?
Better no. It was too tedious. After all those weeks I had freed only a single branch from the granite, so I ran away and fell in with a group of Vrenshurgen.
Dwarfs from the clan Vrenshurgen?
Yes. Nerlan of the clan Vrenshurgen. War wolves. Wolves of war, however you might say it in this tongue. I fell in with them, became drunk on ale, and as they were hunting Nagran, decided that I too should kill a boar and bring it to Hrothgar to appease his anger at me. It wasn't the wisest thing I have done. Even our most skilled warriors fear to hunt Nagran, and I was still more boy than man. Once my mind cleared, I cursed myself for a fool, but I had sworn I would, so I had no choice but to fulfill my oath.
When Oryk paused, Aragorn asked, "What happened?"
"Oh, I killed a Nagra, with help from the Vrenshurgen. But the boar gored me in the shoulder and tossed me into the branches of a nearby tree. The Vrenshurgen had to carry the both of us, the Nagra and me, back to Bregenhold. The boar pleased Hrothgar, and I, despite the ministrations of our best healers, I had to spend the next month resting in bed, which Hrothgar said was punishment enough for defying his orders."
Aragorn watched the dwarf for a while.
"You miss him?"
Oryk stood for a moment with his chin tucked against his stocky chest. Lifting his axe, he struck the granite with the end of the haft, producing a sharp clack that echoed among the trees.
"It has been nigh on 2 centuries since the last Durgrimstvuren, the last clan war, racked our nation, Aragorn. But by Morgothold's black beard, we stand on the brink of another one now."
"Now? Of all times?" exclaimed Aragorn, appalled. "Is it really that bad?"
Oryk scowled.
"It is worse. Tensions between the clans are higher than they have ever been in living memory. Hrothgar's death and Nasawada's invasion of the Empire have served to inflame passions, aggravate old rivalries, and lend strength to those who believe it is folly to cast our lot with the Varden."
"How can they believe that, when Galbatorix has already attacked Trondheim with the Urgals?"
"Because," said Oryk, "they are convinced it is impossible to defeat Galbatorix, and their argument holds much sway with our people. Can you honestly tell me, Aragorn, that if Galbatorix were to confront you and Saphira this very instant, that the two of you could best him?"
Aragorn's throat tightened.
"No."
"I thought not. Those who are opposed to the Varden have blinded themselves to Galbatorix's threat.
They say that if we had refused shelter to the Varden, if we had not accepted you and Sephira into fair Trondheim, then Galbatorix would have had no reason to make war on us. They say that if we just keep to ourselves and remain hidden in our caves and tunnels, we shall have nothing to fear from Galbatorix. They do not realize that Galbatorix's hunger for power is insatiable, and that he will not rest until all of Alagasia lies at his feet.
Oryx shook his head, and the muscles in his forearms bunched and knotted as he pinched the axe blade between his wide fingers.
I will not allow our race to cower in tunnels like frightened rabbits until the wolf outside digs his way in and eats us all. We must continue fighting out of the hope that somehow we can find a way to kill Galbatorix. And I will not allow our nation to disintegrate into a clan war. With circumstances as they are, another Durgrimstfren would destroy our civilization and possibly doom the Varden as well.
His jaw set, Oryk turned toward Aragorn.
For the good of my people, I intend to seek the throne myself. Durgrimston Gedthral, Led Wonu, and Nagra have already pledged their support to me. However, there are many who stand between me and the crown. It will not be easy to garner enough votes to become king. I need to know, Aragorn, will you back me in this?
Crossing his arms, Aragorn walked from one tree to the next and then back again. If I do, my support might turn the other clans against you. Not only will you be asking your people to ally themselves with the Varden, you will be asking them to accept a dragon rider as one of their own, which they have never done before, and I doubt they will want to now.
Aye, it may turn some against me, said Oryk, but it may also gain me the votes of others. Let me be the judge of that. All I wish to know is, will you back me? Aragorn, why do you hesitate?
Aragorn stared at a gnarled root that rose out of the granite by his feet, avoiding Oryk's eyes.
You are concerned about the good of your people, and rightly so. But my concerns are broader. They encompass the good of the Varden and the elves and everyone else who opposes Galbatorix. If it is not likely you can win the crown, and there is another clan chief who could, and who is not unsympathetic to the Varden.
No one would be a more sympathetic Grimstonsborith than I.
I'm not questioning your friendship, Aragorn protested. But if what I said came to pass, and my support might ensure that such a clan chief won the throne, for the good of your people and for the good of the rest of Alagasia, shouldn't I back the dwarf who has the best chance of succeeding?
In a deadly, quiet voice, Oryk said,
You swore a blood oath on the Nurnine, Aragorn. By every law of our realm, you are a member of Durgrimst in Jetum, no matter how greatly others may disapprove. What Hrothgar did by adopting you has no precedent in all of our history, and it cannot be undone unless, as Grimstborith, I banish you from our clan. If you turn against me, Aragorn, you will shame me in front of our entire race, and none will ever trust my leadership again. Moreover, you will prove to your detractors that we cannot trust a dragon rider. Clan members do not betray each other to other clans, Aragorn. It is not done. Not unless you wish to wake up one night with a dagger buried in your heart.
Are you threatening me? Asked Aragorn, just as quietly. Oryk swore and banged his axe against the granite again.
No! I would never lift a hand against you, Aragorn.
You are my foster brother. You are the only rider free of Galbatorix's influence, and blast it if I have not become fond of you during our travels together. But even though I would not harm you, that does not mean the rest of the Ingetum would be so forbearing. I say that not as a threat, but as a statement of fact. You must understand this, Aragorn. If the clan hears you have given your support to another, I may not be able to restrain them. Even though you are our guest and the rules of hospitality protect you, if you speak out against the Ingetum, the clan will see you as having betrayed them. And it is not our custom to allow traitors to remain within our midst. Do you understand me, Aragorn?
What do you expect of me?
Shouted Aragorn. He flung his arms outward and paced back and forth in front of Oric. I swore an oath to Nasoada as well, and those were the orders she gave me.
And you also pledged yourself to Durgrimst Ingetum,
roared Oric. Aragorn stopped and stared at the dwarf.
Would you have me doom all of Alagazia just so you can maintain your standing among the clans?
Do not insult me!
Then don't ask the impossible of me! I will back you if it seems likely you can ascend to the throne, and if not, then I won't. You worry about Durgrimst Ingetum and your race as a whole, while it is my duty to worry about them and all of Alagazia as well.
Aragorn slumped against the cold trunk of a tree. And I cannot afford to offend you or your, I mean, our clan. Or the rest of dwarfdom. In a kinder tone, Oric said,
There is another way, Aragorn. It would be more difficult for you, but it would resolve your quandary.
Oh, what wondrous solution would this be?
Sliding his axe back under his belt, Oric walked over to Aragorn, grasped him by the forearms, and gazed up at him through bushy eyebrows.
Trust me to do the right thing, Aragorn Shadeslayer. Give me the same loyalty you would if you were indeed born of Durgrimst Ingetum. Those under me would never presume to speak out against their own Grimstborith in favor of another clan. If a Grimstborith strikes the rock wrong, it is his responsibility alone. But that does not mean I am oblivious to your concerns.
He glanced down for a moment, then said,
If I cannot be king, trust me not to be so blinded by the prospect of power that I cannot recognize when my bid has failed. If that should happen, not that I believe it shall, then I will of my own volition lend my support to one of the other candidates, for I have no more desire than you to see a Grimstonsborith elected who is hostile to the Varden. And if I should help promote another to the throne, the status and prestige I will place at the service of that clan chief shall of its very nature include your own, since you are Ingetum. Will you trust me, Aragorn? Will you accept me as your Grimstborith, as the rest of my hall-sworn subjects do? Aragorn groaned, and leaned his head against the rough tree and peered up at the crooked bone-white branches wreathed in mist.
Trust! Of all the things Oric could have asked of him, that was the most difficult to grant. Aragorn liked Oric. But to subordinate himself to the dwarf's authority when so much was at stake would be to relinquish even more of his freedom, a prospect he loathed. And along with his freedom he would also be relinquishing part of his responsibility for the fate of Alagazia. Aragorn felt as if he were hanging off the edge of a precipice
and Oric was trying to convince him there was a ledge only a few feet below him, but Aragorn could not bring himself to release his grip, for fear he would fall to his doom. He said, "I would not be a mindless servant for you to order about. When it came to matters of Durgrimst in Jetum, I would defer to you, but in all else, you would have no hold over me."
Oric nodded, his face serious.
"I'm not worried about what mission Nasuada might send you on, nor whom you might kill while fighting the Empire. No. What gives me restless nights when I ought to be sleeping sound as Argon in his cave is imagining you attempting to influence the clan meet's voting. Your intentions are noble, I know, but noble or not, you are unfamiliar with our politics, no matter how well Nasuada may have schooled you. This is mine area of expertise, Aragorn. Let me conduct it in the manner I deem appropriate. It is what Hrothgar groomed me for my entire life."
Aragorn sighed, and with a sensation of falling, he said, "Very well. I will do as you think best about the succession. Grimst Borith Oric."
A broad smile spread across Oric's face. He tightened his grip on Aragorn's forearms, then released him, saying,
"Ah, thank you, Aragorn. You don't know what this means to me. It is good of you, very good of you, and I won't forget it. Not if I live to be 200 years old and my beard grows so long it drags in the dirt."
Despite himself, Aragorn chuckled. "Well, I hope it doesn't grow that long. You would trip over it all the time."
"Perhaps I would at that," said Oric, laughing. "Besides, I rather think Hvedra would cut it short once it reached my knees. She has very definite opinions about the proper length of a beard."
Oric led the way as the two of them departed the forest of stone trees, striding through the colourless mist that swirled among the calcified trunks. They rejoined Oric's 12 warriors, then began to descend the side of Mount Fardor. At the bottom of the valley, they continued in a straight line to the other side, and there the dwarves brought Aragorn to a tunnel, hidden so cleverly within the rock face he never would have found the entrance on his own. It was with regret that Aragorn left behind the pale sunshine and fresh mountain air for the darkness of the tunnel. The passageway was 8 feet wide and 6 feet high, which made it feel quite low to Aragorn. And like all the dwarf tunnels he had visited, it was as straight as an arrow for as far as he could see. He looked back over his shoulder just in time to see the dwarf, Far, swing closed the hinged slab of granite that served as a door to the tunnel, plunging their party into night. A moment later, 14 glowing orbs of differing colours appeared, as the dwarves removed flameless lanterns from their saddlebags. Oric handed one to Aragorn. Then they started forward under the roots of the mountain, and the ponies' hooves filled the tunnel with clashing echoes that seemed to shout at them like angry wraiths. Aragorn grimaced, knowing they would have to listen to the din all the way to Farthendur, for that was where the tunnel ended many leagues thence. He hunched his shoulders and tightened his grip on the straps of his pack, and wished he were with Saphira, flying high above the ground. The Laughing Dead. Roran squatted and gazed through the latticework of willow branches. 200 yards away, 53 soldiers and wagon drivers sat around 3 separate cook fires eating their dinner as dusk rapidly settled over the land. The men had stopped for the night on the broad grass-covered bank next to a nameless river. The wagons, full of supplies for Galbatorix's troops, were parked in a rough half-circle around the fires. Scores of hobbled oxen grazed behind the camp, lowing occasionally to each other. 20 yards or so downstream, however, a soft earth shelf reared high out of the ground, which prevented any attack or escape from that quarter.
"What were they thinking?"
Roram wondered. It was only prudent, when in hostile territory, to camp in a defensible location, which usually meant finding a natural formation to protect your back. Even so, you had to be careful to choose a resting place you could flee from if ambushed. As it was, it would be childishly easy for Roran and the other warriors under Martland's command to sweep out of the brush where they were hiding and pin the men of the Empire in the tip of the V formed by the earthen shelf and the river, where they could pick off the soldiers and drivers at their leisure. It puzzled Roran that trained soldiers would make such an obvious mistake.
Maybe they are from a city, he thought. Or maybe they are merely inexperienced.
He frowned.
Then why would they be entrusted with such a crucial mission? Have you detected any traps? He asked.
He did not have to turn his head to know that Khan was close behind him, as well as Halmar and two other men. Save the four swordsmen, who had joined Martland's company to replace those who had died or been irreparably wounded during their last engagement, Roran had fought alongside all of the men in their group. While he did not like every single one, he trusted them with his life, as he knew they trusted him. It was a bond that transcended age or upbringing. After his first battle, Roran had been surprised by how close he felt to his companions, as well as by how warm they were to him in turn.
"None that I can tell," murmured Khan. "But then..."
"They may have invented new spells you cannot detect, yes, yes.
Is there a magician with them, though?" "I can't tell for sure, but no, I don't think so."
Roran pushed away a shock of narrow willow leaves to better see the layout of the wagons.
"I don't like it," he grumbled. "A magician accompanied the other convoy. Why not this one?"
"There are fewer of us than you might imagine."
Roran scratched his beard, still bothered by the soldier's apparent disregard of common sense.
"Could they be trying to invite an attack? They don't seem prepared for one, but appearances are hardly everything. What sort of trap could they have prepared for us? No one else is within 30 leagues, and Murtagh and Thorn were last spotted flying north from Feinster."
"Send the signal," he said. "But tell Martland it bothers me they camped here. Either they're idiots, or they have some sort of defense invisible to us. Magic or other trickery of the king." Silence. Then,
"I sent it. Martland says he shares your concern, but unless you want to run back to Nasawada with your tail tucked between your legs, we try our luck."
Roran grunted and turned away from the soldiers. He gestured with his chin, and the other men scampered with him on hands and knees to where they had left their horses. Standing, Roran mounted Snowfire.
"Whoa, steady boy," he whispered,
petting Snowfire as the stallion tossed his head. In the dim light, Snowfire's mane and hide gleamed like silver. Not for the first time, Roran wished his horse were a less visible shade. A nice bay or chestnut, perhaps. Taking his shield from where it hung by his saddle, Roran fit his left arm through the straps, then pulled his hammer from his belt. He dry-swallowed, a familiar tightness between his shoulders, and readjusted his grip on the hammer. When the five men were ready, Khan raised a finger, and his eyelids drifted half-closed, and his lips twitched as if he were talking with himself. A cricket sounded nearby. Khan's eyelids snapped open.
"Remember, keep your gaze directed downward until your vision adjusts, and even then, don't look at the sky."
Then he began to chant in the ancient language, incomprehensible words that shivered with power. Roran covered himself with his shield and squinted at his saddle, as a pure white light, bright as the noonday sun, illuminated the landscape. The stark glow originated from a point somewhere above the camp. Roran resisted the temptation to see exactly where. Shouting, he kicked Snowfire in the ribs and hunched over the horse's neck as his steed leaped forward. On either side, Khan and the other warriors did the same, brandishing their weapons. Branches tore at Roran's head and shoulders, and then Snowfire broke free of the trees and raced toward the camp at full gallop. Two other groups of horsemen also thundered toward the camp, one led by Martland, the other Ulhart. The soldiers and drivers cried out in alarm and covered their eyes. Staggering about like blind men, they scrabbled after their weapons while trying to position themselves to repel the attack. Roran made no attempt to slow Snowfire. Spurring the stallion once more, he rose high in the stirrups and held on with all his strength as Snowfire jumped over the slight gap between two wagons. His teeth clattered as they landed. Snowfire kicked dirt into one of the fires, sending up a burst of sparks. The rest of Roran's group jumped the wagons as well. Knowing they would attend to the soldiers behind him, Roran concentrated on those in front. Aiming Snowfire at one of the men, he jabbed at the soldier with the end of his hammer and broke the man's nose, splashing crimson blood across his face. Roran dispatched the man with a second blow to the head, then parried a sword from another soldier. Farther down the curved line of wagons, Martland, Ulhart, and their men also jumped into the camp, alighting with a clack of hooves and a jangle of armor and weapons. A horse screamed and fell as a soldier wounded it with a spear. Roran blocked the soldier's sword a second time, then wrapped the man's sword hand, breaking bones and forcing the man to drop his weapon. Without pause, Roran struck the man in the center of his red tunic, cracking his sternum and felling the gasping, mortally wounded soldier. Roran twisted in the saddle, searching the camp for his next opponent. His muscles vibrated with frantic excitement. Every detail around him was as sharp and clear as if it were etched in glass. He felt invincible, invulnerable. Time itself seemed to stretch and slow, so that a confused moth that fluttered past him appeared to be flying through honey instead of air. Then a pair of hands clamped down on the back of his mail hauberk and yanked him off Snowfire and slammed him into the hard ground, knocking the breath out of him. Roran's sight flickered and went black for a moment. When he recovered, he saw that the first soldier he had attacked was sitting on his chest, choking him. The soldier blotted out the source of light Khan had created in the sky. A white halo surrounded his head and shoulders, casting his features in such deep shadow Roran could make out nothing of his face but the flash of bared teeth. The soldier tightened his fingers around Roran's throat as Roran gasped for air. Roran groped after his hammer, which he had dropped, but it was not within reach. Tensing his neck to keep the soldier from crushing the life out of him, he drew his dagger from his belt and drove it through the soldier's hauberk, through his gambeson, and between the ribs on the soldier's left side. The soldier did not even flinch, nor did his grip relax. A continuous stream of gurgling laughter emanated from the soldier. The lurching, heart-stopping chuckle, hideous in the extreme, turned Roran's stomach cold with fear. He remembered the sound from before. He had heard it while watching the Varden fight the men who felt no pain on the grassy field beside the Jeet River. In a flash, he understood why the soldiers had chosen such a poor campsite. "They do not care if they are trapped or not, for we cannot hurt them." Roran's vision turned red, and yellow stars danced before his eyes. Teetering on the edge of unconsciousness, he yanked the dagger free and stabbed upward into the soldier's armpit, twisting the blade in the wound. Gouts of hot blood spurted over his hand, but the soldier did not seem to notice. The world exploded in blotches of pulsing colors as the soldier smashed Roran's head against the ground, once, twice, three times. Roran bucked his hips, trying without success to throw the man off. Blind and desperate, he slashed at where he guessed the man's face to be and felt the dagger catch in soft flesh. He pulled the dagger back slightly, then lunged in that direction, feeling the impact as the tip of the blade struck bone. The pressure around Roran's neck vanished. Roran lay where he was, his chest heaving, then rolled over and vomited, throat burning. Still gasping and coughing, he staggered upright and saw the soldier sprawled motionless next to him, the dagger protruding from the man's left nostril. "Go for the head!" shouted Roran, despite his raw throat. "The head!" He left the dagger buried in the soldier's nostril and retrieved his hammer from the trampled ground where it had fallen, pausing long enough to also grab an abandoned spear, which he held with his shield hand. Jumping over the fallen soldier, He ran toward Halmar, who was on foot as well, and dueling three soldiers at once. Before the soldiers noticed him, Roran bashed the two closest ones in the head so hard he split their helms. The third he left to Halmar, instead bounding over to the soldier whose sternum he had broken and whom he had left for dead. He found the man sitting against the wheel of a wagon, spitting up clotted blood, and struggling to string a bow. Roran gored him through an eye with the spear. Pieces of grey flesh clung to the blade of the spear as he pulled it free. An idea occurred to Roran then. He threw the spear at a man in a red tunic on the other side of the nearest fire, impaling him through the torso, then slid the haft of his hammer under his belt and strung the soldier's bow. Placing his back against a wagon, Roran began to shoot the soldiers rushing about the encampment, attempting either to kill them with a lucky shot to the face, the throat, or the heart, or to cripple them so his companions could more easily dispatch them. If nothing else, he reasoned that an injured soldier might bleed to death before the fight ended. The initial confidence of the attack had faded into confusion. The Varden were scattered and dismayed, some on their steeds, some on foot, and most bloodied. At least five, so far as Roran could tell, had died when soldiers they had thought slain had returned to assail them. How many soldiers were left it was impossible to tell in the throng of flailing bodies, but Roran could see that they still outnumbered the scant 25 or so of the remaining Varden. "They could tear us into pieces with their bare hands while we tried to hack them apart," he realized. He searched with his eyes among the frenzy for Snowfire, and saw that the white horse had run farther down the river, where he now stood by a willow tree, nostrils flared and ears plastered flat against his skull. With the bow, Roran killed four more soldiers and wounded over a score. When he had only two arrows left, he spotted Khan standing on the other side of the camp, dueling a soldier by the corner of a burning tent. Drawing the bow until the fletching on the arrow tickled his ear, Roran shot the soldier in the chest. The soldier stumbled, and Khan decapitated him. Roran tossed the bow aside and, hammer in hand, ran over to Khan and shouted, "Can't you kill them with magic?" For a moment Khan could only pant. Then he shook his head and said, "Every spell I cast was blocked." The light from the burning tent gilded the side of his face. Roran cursed. "Together then," he cried, and hefted his shield. Shoulder to shoulder, the two of them advanced upon the nearest group of soldiers, a cluster of eight men surrounding three of the Varden. The next few minutes were a spasm of flashing weapons, tearing flesh, and sudden pains for Roran. The soldiers tired more slowly than ordinary men, and they never shirked from an attack, nor did they slacken in their efforts, even when suffering from the most horrific injuries. The exertion of the fight was so great Roran's nausea returned, and after the eighth soldier fell, he leaned over and vomited again. He spat to clear his mouth of bile. One of the Varden they had sought to rescue had died in the struggle, slain by a knife in the kidneys, but the two who were still standing joined forces with Roran and Khan, and with them they charged the next batch of soldiers. "Drive them toward the river!" Roran shouted. The water and the mud would limit the soldiers' movement and perhaps allow the Varden to gain the upper hand. Not far away, Martland had succeeded in rallying the 12 of the Varden who were still on their horses, and they were already doing what Roran had suggested, herding the soldiers back toward the shining water. The soldiers and the few drivers who were still alive resisted. They shoved their shields against the men on foot. They jabbed spears at the horses. But in spite of their violent opposition, the Varden forced them to retreat a step at a time until the men in the crimson tunics stood knee-deep in the fast-flowing water, half-blinded by the uncanny light shining down on them. "Hold the line!" shouted Martland, dismounting and planting himself with spread legs on the edge of the riverbank. "Don't let them regain the shore!" Roran dropped into a half-crouch, ground his heels into the soft earth until he was comfortable with his stance, and waited for the large soldier standing in the cold water several feet in front of him to attack. With a roar, the soldier splashed out of the shallows, swinging his sword at Roran, which Roran caught on his shield. Roran retaliated with a stroke of his hammer, but the soldier blocked him with his own shield and then cut at Roran's legs. For several seconds they exchanged blows, but neither wounded the other. Then Roran shattered the man's left forearm, knocking him back several paces. The soldier merely smiled and uttered a mirthless, soul-chilling laugh. Roran wondered whether he or any of his companions would survive the night.
"They're harder to kill than snakes. We can cut them to ribbons, and they'll still keep coming at us unless we hit something vital."
His next thought vanished as the soldier rushed at him again, his notched sword flickering in the pale light like a tongue of flame. Thereafter, the battle assumed a nightmarish quality for Roran. The strange, baleful light gave the water and the soldiers an unearthly aspect, bleaching them of colour and projecting long, thin, razor-sharp shadows across the shifting water, while beyond and all around, the fullness of night prevailed. Again and again he repelled the soldiers who stumbled out of the water to kill him, hammering at them until they were barely recognizable as human, and yet they would not die. With every blow, medallions of black blood stained the surface of the river like blots of spilled ink and drifted away on the current. The deadly sameness of each clash numbed and horrified Roran. No matter how hard he strove, there was always another mutilated soldier there to slash and stab at him. And always the demented giggling of men who knew they were dead and yet continued to maintain a semblance of life even while the Varden destroyed their bodies. And then silence. Roran remained crouched behind his shield, with his hammer half raised, gasping and drenched with sweat and blood. A minute passed before it dawned on him that no one stood in the water before him. He glanced left and right three times, unable to grasp that the soldiers were finally, blessedly, irrevocably dead. A corpse floated past him in the glittering water. An inarticulate bellow escaped him as a hand gripped his right arm. He whipped around, snarling and pulling away, only to see Karn next to him. The wan, gore-smeared spellcaster was speaking.
"We won, Roran! Eh? They're gone! We vanquished them!"
Roran let his arms drop and tilted his head back. Too tired even to sit. He felt as if his senses were abnormally sharp, and yet his emotions were dull, muted things, tamped down somewhere deep inside of himself. He was glad it was so, otherwise he thought he would go mad.
"Gather up and inspect the wagons," shouted Markland. "The sooner you bestir yourselves, the sooner we can leave this accursed place. Karn, attend to Welmar. I don't like the look of that gash."
With an enormous effort of will, Roran turned and trudged across the bank to the nearest wagon. Blinking away the sweat that dripped from his brow, he saw that of their original force, only 9 were still fit to stand. He pushed the observation out of his mind. "Morn later, not now." As Martland Redbeard walked across the corpse-strewn encampment, a soldier whom Roran had assumed was dead flipped over and from the ground lopped off the Earl's right hand. With a movement so graceful it appeared practiced, Martland kicked the sword out of the soldier's grip, then knelt on the soldier's throat, and using his left hand, drew a dagger from his belt and stabbed the man through one of his ears, killing him. His face flushed and strained, Martland shoved the stump of his wrist under his left armpit and waved away everyone who rushed over to him.
"Leave me alone. It's hardly a wound at all. Get to those wagons! Unless you wastrels hurry up, we'll be here so long my beard will turn white as snow. Go on!"
When Karn refused to budge, however, Martland scowled and shouted,
"Be gone with you, or I'll have you flogged for insubordination, I will!"
Karn held up Martland's wayward hand.
"I might be able to reattach it.
but I'll need a few minutes.
Ah, confound it, give me that! Exclaimed Martland, and snatched his hand away from Khan.
He tucked it inside his tunic.
Stop fretting about me and save Welmar and Lindel if you can. You can try reattaching it once we've put a few leagues between us and these monsters.
It might be too late then, said Khan.
That was an order, spellcaster, not a request, thundered Martland.
As Khan retreated, the Earl used his teeth to tie off the sleeve of his tunic over the stump of his arm, which he again stuck in his left armpit. Sweat beaded his face.
Right then. What misbegotten items are hidden in those confounded wagons?
Rope!
Someone shouted. Whiskey! Shouted someone else.
Martland grunted.
Ulhart, you record the figures for me.
Roran helped the others as they rifled through each of the wagons, calling out the contents to Ulhart. Afterward, they slaughtered the teams of oxen and lit the wagons on fire as before. Then they rounded up their horses and mounted them, tying the injured into their saddles. When they were ready to depart, Khan gestured toward the flare of light in the sky and murmured a long, tangled word. Night enveloped the world. Glancing up, Roran beheld a throbbing afterimage of Khan's face superimposed over the faint stars, and then as he became accustomed to the darkness, he beheld the soft grey shapes of thousands of disoriented moths scattering across the sky like the shades of men's souls. His heart heavy within him, Roran touched his heels to Snowfire's flanks and rode away from the remnants of the convoy.
Blood on the Rocks. Frustrated, Aragorn stormed out of the circular chamber buried deep under the center of Trondheim. The oak door slammed shut behind him with a hollow boom. Aragorn stood, with his hands on his hips, in the middle of the arched corridor outside the chamber, and glared at the floor, which was tessellated with rectangles of agate and jade. Since he and Oric had arrived in Trondheim 3 days ago, the 13 chiefs of the dwarf clans had done nothing but argue about issues that Aragorn considered inconsequential, such as which clans had the right to graze their flocks in certain disputed pastures. As he listened to the clan chiefs debate obscure points of their legal code, Aragorn often felt like shouting that they were being blind fools who were going to doom all of Alagazia to Galbatorix's rule unless they put aside their petty concerns and chose a new ruler without further delay. Still lost in thought, Aragorn slowly walked down the corridor, barely noticing the 4 guards who followed him as they did wherever he went, nor the dwarves he passed in the hall, who greeted him with variations of Arjutlam.
The worst one is Iorunen,
Aragorn decided.
The dwarf woman was the Grimstborith of Durgrimst Vrenshurgen, a powerful warlike clan, and she had made it clear from the very beginning of the deliberations that she intended to have the throne for herself. Only one other clan, the Urjard, had openly pledged themselves to her cause, but as she had demonstrated on multiple occasions during the meetings between the clan chiefs, she was clever, cunning, and able to twist most any situation to her advantage.
She might make an excellent queen, Aragorn admitted to himself, but she's so devious it's impossible to know whether she would support the Varden once she was enthroned.
He allowed himself a wry smile. Talking with Iorunen was always awkward for him. The dwarves considered her a great beauty, and even by the standards of humans she cut a striking figure. Besides which, she seemed to have developed a fascination with Aragorn that he was unable to fathom. In every conversation they had, she insisted upon making allusions to the dwarves' history and mythology that Aragorn did not understand, but that seemed to amuse Oric and the other dwarves to no end. In addition to Iorunen, 2 other clan chiefs had emerged as rivals for the throne. Ganel, chief of Durgrimst Quan, and Nardo, chief of Durgrimst Nurl Carathan. As the custodians of the dwarves' religion, the Quan wielded enormous influence among their race, but so far Ganel had obtained the support of but two other clans, Durgrimst Regni Hefthin and Durgrimst Ebardak, a clan primarily devoted to scholarly research. In contrast, Nardo had forged a larger coalition, consisting of the clans Feldunost, Fanghur, and Asswelden Rak'anuin. Whereas Iorunan seemed to want the throne merely for the power she would gain thereafter, and Ganel did not seem inherently hostile to the Varden, although neither was he friendly toward them, Nardo was openly and vehemently opposed.